there were so many opportunities to ponder what's going on with different characters, what's going on with tensions between generations, what's going on with family relations. It's as if psychoanalysis shed a new light on literature, and it's as if literature, its persuasiveness and accomplishment, great literature, seemed to confirm psychoanalytic understanding of how human beings internally are put together.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org.
Welcome, everyone, to today's podcast. I am Dr. Stephen Rolfe, an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and chair of the American Psychoanalytic Association's Committee on Corporate and Organizational Consulting. I'm an executive coach at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and managing principal of Rolfe Advisory and Sante Advisory, firms specializing in psychodynamic leadership advisory services for CEOs, family business owners, entrepreneurs, and leaders in crisis. I'm very pleased today to welcome Dr. Paul Schwaber to our podcast. Dr. Schwaber is Professor of Letters Emeritus at Wesleyan University and a practicing psychoanalyst. For many years, Director of the College of Letters, Wesleyan's undergraduate major in Western literature, philosophy, and history, he has published extensively on the relations of imaginative literature and psychoanalysis. He co-edited Of Poetry and Power, Poems Occasioned by the Presidency and the Death of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Basic Books, and is the author of The Cast of Characters, A Reading of Ulysses, Yale University Press. In 1993, he was given the Robert S. Liebert Award in Applied Psychoanalysis by the Columbia Center for Psychoanalysis and the Association of Psychoanalytic Medicine, and in 2014, the Edith Sapshin Teaching Award by the American Psychoanalytic Association. A graduate of the Western New England Institute, he was chair of its faculty and has served as its president. He has served on the editorial board of the International Journal of Psychoanalysis and at present is on the board of the James Joyce Quarterly, the Journal of Applied Psychoanalytic Studies, Psychoanalytic Quarterly, and the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association. He and his wife, Dr. Rosemary Balsam, now edit the book review section of the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association. Paul, welcome. I'm particularly pleased to be able to interview you at this time of year, knowing we are approaching Bloomsday and appreciating how important Ulysses and James Joyce have been in both of our lives. But more of that later. As you've been engaged for most of your life with two professions, you represent the epitome of what we are trying to focus on in this podcast. Perhaps we could begin by hearing from you and your telling the audience how this interest in two impossible professions began.
I had an ordinary childhood in Brooklyn, New York. Went to a big public high school after a Zionist yeshiva. And once I got to college, I found that literature courses, whether from the ancient world or a modern were really taking my interest. There's a sense that I recognize how fascinating people are depicted sufficiently, and also how resonant lyric poetry can be. And a very fine teacher I had there, a professor who eventually became a good friend to my wife and me, but early on he sort of exemplified how a sensitive, manly guy really was up to talking in a way that brought things to life. Not too long after that, in my second year, I studied the Canterbury Tales by Chaucer, and I had a sense that, boy, these people are so varied and so interesting. It reminds me of riding on the BMT, the subway, in New York from Brooklyn to Manhattan. So that's the way it got started. And I got a fellowship to go to Berkeley for my master's, and then I came to Columbia and New York for my PhD. I had read, when I was out in Berkeley, I read Lionel Trilling, and I got so excited, I applied to Columbia, and I said, I must study with Lionel Trilling. And it turned out that he was a very pleasant guy, and he was my model for somebody who knew, obviously, was a marvelous critic and influential, but was very respectful of psychoanalysis and was superb on literature. So that's the way that part got started. Now, I also found getting my PhD that I was having certain kinds of trouble growing up and decided to go into analysis. And that's exactly what happened, and it turned out to be not only an interesting and successful analysis, but it was intriguing, you know, the way the mind works, the way interactions with others work, the way literature reflects human experience, and in that way seems to lend itself to psychoanalytic understanding. And as such, two fields began to merge. When my analyst moved to another town after several years of work, and I wanted to continue, I went to see the fellow who was sharing his office suite with him, and he very kindly said, you needed a training analyst. Why don't you look into the Western New England Institute and find out how you get to work with a training analyst? And that's exactly what happened.
Was this after you had your PhD then?
No, this was while I was studying. And I began a training after, that's right, it was after I finished my PhD and was working at Wesleyan already. And I was seeing an analyst in New Haven. And when I went to see this second analyst, it was he who suggested that I look into finding a training analyst, which was a very generous thing for him to do and to recommend. But it was clear that I was very interested in the psychoanalytic, psychodynamics of characters in literature, and the complexities of moments as rendered in literature, and how much psychoanalysis opened up to them, and how much they, as rendered, seemed to verify what psychoanalysis recognized. So that was the beginning of the joint interest, and the Western New England Institute was just willing to accept me. I went and talked to them. I was in analysis already with a training analyst, and I explained the fascination I had, and I told them that I really felt that in order to do this work, I had to have analytic experience with minds other than my own. I needed to have the opportunity to work as a psychoanalyst with other people and get some of the sense of the infinite variety of human minds for all that we could find commonalities psychoanalytically.
Paul, when you first decided to do the training analysis, were you thinking that you were going to be a clinical psychoanalyst, or were you thinking you were going to use this experience in order to understand literature better?
I wasn't confident that I would get training, but I knew that if I had any hope of getting training, I had to get a training analyst. And I wanted to go on with my analysis. Now, it turned out that Western New England was very closely allied with Yale, and a whole lot of people were connected with Yale, usually in the medical school or the psychology department. But it was very welcoming to me with my humanities focus, and they were just very hospitable and trained me. They let me join the next class that was beginning, and I began taking courses, had colleagues, and I also would continue with my analysis, which not only alerted me to the kinds of things that an analyst has to be aware of and an analysand should be aware of, at least what I had to be aware of, but also of the sense that I could do the work, and I found that fascinating.
So you began training with no previous clinical experience, no clinical degree, no waivers or anything like that?
No, there was nothing. They just had to accept me.
And they did.
And they did. And eventually, when I graduated, the American Psychoanalytic Association let me join as a member. So that was my official recognition.
And how common was it in those days for somebody to be able to pursue training without any previous clinical experience?
Well, first of all, as I indicated, I had clinical experience by being an analysand.
Right.
However, I don't know how common it was. There were a few people that I got to know, a Yale PhD who was training at the time, and she helped to convince me that I ought to give it a try. And there weren't that many, obviously, but it was not a big hassle. Years later, when my colleague Elizabeth Young Brule, who after all wrote the biography of Anna Freud and did other marvelous work before she died much too young, when she wanted to get training, she had to get a social work degree before they could train her. So clearly, times have changed. Things were more relaxed originally when I was going through in the early 1970s.
So how did you manage to be teaching and do all of the training at the same time?
I got up early in the morning. I did most of my teaching in the afternoon. My analytic hours were morning sessions for myself and for patients when I began seeing patients. And classes at Western New England often were on the weekend. So it was all doable, and it was a half-hour drive from Wesleyan in Middletown, Connecticut, down to New Haven, and I was young and able to drive a lot. That was the way it went. It was a very structured life after a while. I had definite arrangements, and I was also in the process of trying to get tenure, so I had to do some writing. Fortunately, it worked out. You know, there were times when it looked as if it wouldn't, but I got lucky at crucial moments.
So maybe you could talk a bit about how your interest in the two professions really dovetailed and how they kind of informed each other. I suppose you feel that both professions informed the other.
Yeah, I think that they confirm one another. For example, as I wrote in a little article I published in the Journal of the American about my two professions, wondering how to listen as an analyst, picking up associations, not imposing formulations, but really learning from the patient. And one of the things I noticed early, though I was quite anxious about whether I would be able to do it since I had no previous experience with it, one of the things I noticed was that it was a lot like reading poetry, whether narrative poetry or lyric poetry, the importance of silences, the shape of a poem, like the shape of an hour. And the parallels were fascinating to me and obviously helpful to me. I didn't feel as if I was intruding, doing something I didn't know anything about. It turned out I did know about it. I had learned it in a different direction originally, but it was transferable to what I was learning now. And I also found that reading short stories or reading ancient literature or reading the Bible, I was teaching a whole lot of a range of Western culture in this program that I was a professor in. And there were so many opportunities to ponder what's going on with different characters, what's going on with tensions between generations, what's going on with family relations. It's as if psychoanalysis shed a new light on literature, and it's as if literature, its persuasiveness and accomplishment, great literature, seemed to confirm psychoanalytic understanding of how human beings internally are put together. So I did find that there was a nice mix of the two, and I was able to introduce it into my teaching. For example, I taught an undergraduate course on Freud's work from beginning to end, and inevitably, any other course I was teaching was subject to psychoanalytic perspectives, comments, not imposing of definitiveness, but suggesting and opening up the possibility for people to think about. Often it led to interesting discussions. To be sure, there were usually one or two students who objected and said that I was sounding like somebody from Vienna. So, nonetheless, it proved very fruitful, and it informed my teaching for the greater part of my career at Wesleyan.
Do you feel that literature should be included in more of psychoanalytic curricula?
Well, I think it should be included if there are people who feel comfortable with it and want to use it. It would be fascinating, but it would have to be something that a teacher wanted to try. I'm sure it would be fascinating and in some way an addition to the notion of clinical reports on, you know, analytic patients and being talked about in classes or with supervisors. It just would amplify the availability of recognition of complex truths about human beings that as analysts and as literary critics or readers we recognize. Lately, I've been teaching a course on tragedy at the Institute, and it's been a course in mostly Shakespeare, Shakespeare's great tragedy, and it's endless, the fascination that Shakespeare brings to psychoanalysis and what psychoanalysis can amplify about the plays, about the characters.
I think I recall that you used an example in the paper that you referred to about how your analytic perspective helped you to better understand or explain one of Robert Burns's poems.
Oh, yeah. My love is like a red, red rose.
Yeah. Could you say a bit more about that?
Well, it's a fascinating poem and very well liked. It isn't usually remembered all the way through. And there's a tension in the poem. There's no doubt about the genuineness of what he's saying and the attractiveness of the compliment he's playing. At the same time, there is the fact that he's about to leave. And he would be yearning for her though he went 1,000 miles. So we have, in other words, conflict. And it didn't have to be recognized as a conflict as a psychoanalyst would see it, but it was part of the appeal of the poem that the speaker was so genuinely flattering to the woman at the same time as he was leaving her without any clear sign of when he's coming back.
That focus then on a kind of ambivalence that you might not ordinarily pay attention to without the kind of background that we have.
At least I think that that's true. I had taught that poem long before I started and read it long before I started studying to be an analyst. And it isn't that I didn't know that he was complimenting her as he was leaving. And I used to marvel at how convincing the compliment was, but when I looked at it later, I realized that there was an awful lot of pull away from her, even as he was genuinely complimenting her and wishing to return. So, in other words, it was a human love situation.
Speaking of human love situations, I think we've come to the point in this interview where we should turn to Ulysses and talk about your lifelong interest in Ulysses. And perhaps you could give our audience some sense of why Ulysses and Joyce has been the novel that you really gravitated to and, in fact, wrote your book about, which I will say teaches as much about analysis as it does about Joyce and Ulysses.
Well, thank you. When I finished my PhD from Columbia, I spent a year at Wellesley College. And one of the things I was teaching there was the history of the English novel. It was a course that was all set up, and I realized it ended with Joyce's Ulysses, and I had never read it. And I went to see a woman professor I had befriended, and I said, "This is the situation." And she said, "Well, that's an awfully good idea. Why not teach it as you read it?" And it turns out to be a book that, although very difficult and forbidding to people by reputation, and also the first three chapters being kind of tough to get through, that it read aloud and taught to students that way is a very funny book and also a very deep and interesting book, presenting characterizations that are really memorable. Leopold Bloom, Stephen Dedalus, Molly Bloom, whole host of individuals in Dublin on June 16th, 1904, and the overarching parallel to or the model of the Odyssey of Homer made it a very ambitious book, but at the same time, it turned out to be a very friendly book if one wasn't scared and if one did enough thought with the help of people who had written about it already. And I've found it fascinating in a lot of ways. For example, Joyce was writing it in the early 20th century, essentially when Freud was doing his work. Joyce knew a little bit about Freud and dismissed him. And Freud didn't know anything about Joyce, as far as we know. Nonetheless, they were both fascinated with the complexity of the human mind and the interactions between people. And they both did a wonderful job in their own way of rendering humanity. Joyce did it in a way that was daunting in some ways because it's a narrative with so much experimentation and ways of telling the story. But nonetheless, the characterizations remain actually consistent, complicated each in their own ways, but consistently recognizable. Bloom from beginning to end is Leopold Bloom. Stephen Dedalus, the same can be said about him. And the book ends, of course, with Molly Bloom thinking to herself, not even speaking. And it's a very famous, you might say, soliloquy, and very entertaining. And it was also one of the ways in which the book had trouble being authorized to be published and sold in the United States. It required a legal action eventually to get permission to even bring it into the United States and also to England.
Before you get to the end of the novel, perhaps you could mention the example that you gave at the end of your paper that we'll make this paper available to the readers of the podcast, but you mentioned an example, I think, that again talked about your involvement in the intersection of the literary and the psychoanalytic world in your description of the penultimate chapter and moment in the novel. Maybe you could talk a little about that because I think it would be of interest.
The end of an epic story about one day, June 16, 1904, involving this complicated Jewish salesman who is understood by everybody in the book to be Jewish, who feels himself to be Jewish, but who knows he isn't. And also this young writer who is not writing and who's mourning the death of his mother, Jesuit trained, but no longer studying to be a priest, and trying to become a writer. And during the course of the day, they manage somehow to run into one another in the red light district late at night. And Leopold Bloom brings Stephen home after Stephen sort of knocked down by a policeman and almost arrested, being drunk and sort of out of control, and Bloom takes him in. Bloom knows his father, Stephen's father, and not that they're friends, but he seems to feel responsible in uncomplicated ways. He's always looking for a young man whom he can look after since his own boy, little boy, died to the great chagrin of himself and his wife, Molly. The time they spend together and they're not really staying together, but separating. After this, all these chapters of fascinating narrative and revelation about the characters, Joyce wrote this chapter determining what we should finally understand or at least know about the two men spending some time together and then separating, presumably forever, their possibility of a friendship not working out. And the way in which the story is told in that chapter is a question and answer, which Joyce called mathematical catechism. In other words, recognition of it as importantly true, but also being presented in ways that had no feeling it was entirely scientific or entirely precise, but not in any way itself revealing any feeling. It's a fascinating moment because it's the penultimate chapter. It's the last one before Molly Bloom, and it was a way in which I think Joyce was saying goodbye to these characters that he had so fully presented and so magnificently presented. It was his way of saying goodbye. And for readers, it's also a way of allowing them to go. What happened to all the feeling that we had invested in them, all the identification with them, all the empathy? Well, it turned, you might say, into stone. or there was a refusal of feeling there, and it became a way of readers letting them go, though we're immediately pulled back into feeling by Molly's reverie.
There's a moment towards the end there where Stephen is singing a anti-Semitic song to Bloom. Just wondering how you understand that in the context of what you're speaking about.
Stephen is good and drunk at that point. Bloom has brought him home. Stephen starts singing and sings this anti-Semitic song, and Bloom wishes that he had sung about something else. And it seemed as if Stephen, without quite consciously deciding it, managed to convey the fact that he was going to separate. He was going to separate from Bloom, even if it was a matter of singing an anti-Semitic song, though not lingering over the fact that it was anti-Semitic. Bloom picked it up, and it became a way of allowing Stephen to separate. And it's also the way in which Bloom began thinking not about the song, but wishing he had sung about something else, and thinking instead about his daughter, who is living away, and who he has to put up with, recognizing that he would eventually be losing her. And that was hard in its way, too. And the question was, is he going to lose Molly? Because he was cuckolded this day. It turns out that he won't. It turns out that her thoughts keep returning to him. And the story is sufficiently told in her thoughts in the last chapter to have, you might say, a happy ending, or at least the possibility of a pleasant life together. But that penultimate chapter in which the characters and the narrator himself, who has been such a performer, essentially just tells the story in as objectified a way as he can without revealing any kind of feeling. And all of it seems to me comparable psychoanalytically to a projection. It's as if he's saying, Joyce is saying to the reader, I don't want to lose these people, but I have to let them go. You can let them go. You can feel the loss. I don't want to. And scholarly convention, this issue came up at some point, and I was able to point it out, that that's a way in which Joyce could make sure that we had the feelings, were left with the feelings of loss, that he was, in his narrative, managing to get rid of or claim to be denying.
Well, I likewise have the feeling that I don't want to let this interview go.
Oh, aren't you nice? Yeah.
But I do want to thank you for, as is so often the case, such a illuminating time together. And I just want to say in full disclosure, Paul, that I've so enjoyed our being able to co-lead the discussion group yearly of the Ulysses and psychoanalysis at the meetings of the American, and I look forward to continuing to do that on a yearly basis. But I really want to thank you. Again, I'll urge the audience to look at your book on Ulysses, Cast of Characters, and we will have that available on the IPA Off the Couch website. Thank you again.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank all the people who have been listening.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.